This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people.
Welcome to the MDT. This is the sixth episode of the MDT Kindness series, and we've been working through five episodes so far, looking at how we can be kind, in essential.
if you didn't get that from the title. So how we can work together in our teams to be kind to ourselves and each other, to do the best that we can for the people that we work with.
Yeah. And I'm Ian Wilkinson, and today I am joined by...
Today you're joined by Joe Preston, a geriatrician in South London. It's an honour that I'm here.
It is. You've never been here before. And I'm a geriatrician down in Surrey. And today we're going to be joined by an amazing guest who we will introduce you to in just a little while. But first, Joe, let's have a look at... what did we find on social media this week?
So I found a really nice thing from Helen Bevan, who I know we've used some of her tweets in previous series and episodes. And I thought this was quite nice, especially with what we're going to talk about later, which is about being expert and being fine-tuned into what we do and kind of honing our skills. And this was a tweet that she's put. If you've not come across her before, she does a lot of stuff about healthcare leadership and management. And she's adapted a graphic from someone else called Prof Hamill. We'll tweet this on our social media account so that you can have a look at it if you want to see it further. And she talks about how in healthcare, we quite often put massive amounts of effort into improving our delivery performance by changing our processes and practices. But then in this infographic that she's put the knowledge structure of an organization, and actually processes, practices and performance are actually at the bottom of that. So at the top, she has what's the paradigm that we're working in, what's the problem that we're trying to work towards, what are our principles, and then come the processes, performances and practices. And what she talks about is, or what this infographic shows, is about the differences in a very bureaucratic organization versus an organization which focuses on being quite human-centered and worker-centered. So moving down the table, if you like, at the paradigm level, a bureaucratic organization might see that humans are resources to be used in this system, whereas a human-centered organization would start with the presumption that humans are resourceful. So they will find solutions, they will contribute. Moving underneath paradigm to problem, in a bureaucratic organization, they might look at maximizing compliance to solve the problem, whereas a human-centered organization would look at maximizing contribution to contribute to solving that problem. And then looking at principles and then processes, performances and practices down on the bureaucratic organization side, it talks a lot about things like stratification, standardization, formalization, routinization, like so many sizations. That's not a word at all, but you know, that a lot of that there, things being very predictable. And on the human-centered side, it says things like ownership, meritocracy, experimentation, people having agency, working in communities, being openness and having balance around these things, which I thought was really nice. I think it really links into what we've been talking about all throughout this with our quiet leadership, but in particular, those last aspects of ownership, meritocracy and agency really, I think, are in tune with what we're going to talk about later with Professor Roger Kneebone, which is around being expert in what we do.
Yeah, developing our expertise. Yeah.
And
hopefully you will have all been developing some expertise in random acts of kindness, because we said to you last week we want you to do some random acts of kindness. Now, we record these slightly out of sync, as you may have guessed, so you may well have sent us all of the wonderful random acts of kindness that you've done. And if you did, if you're the first person to send us that chart filled in, we will send you some lovely MDT goodies, and we'll be in touch with you on Twitter. Also, we have been working through the breathing challenge, and we will touch on that a little bit later. But I hope you've been working through that with us. And just a little reminder, there is a breathing MOT and a couple of other questionnaires on the front page of our website. And if you look at Twitter, we'll send those out as well. And please interact with that, fill them in, encourage your colleagues at work too, and use those bits of information to try and sort of see how well some of the breathing techniques and things are working for you. I know what Jess has always said to us is that what gets measured gets managed. And so I think if you take the 3 minutes that it takes to do your breath MOT, you will measure how things are. And then hopefully through the techniques that she's teaching you through this series, you will manage whatever it is that you've measured. But this week, we are going to be looking at what it means to become expert. And how do we tread that path from not knowing anything about a subject to being a master in that area of knowledge?
But first, before we get started with today's episode, we're going to hear from someone that works at Redhill about what they do to kind of balance work and life. And as we mentioned, we do record these slightly out of kilter. You'll note her refer to the weather, and it was the weather at the time it's recorded, which was terrible compared to when we're recording, where it's lovely.
I am Kim and I'm the HLO, which is a hospital liaison officer for South Central Ambulance, and I make sure that people come into the hospital and leave the hospital safely. Well, I do go to a yoga class, which I do enjoy, and that does help me relax, but it's mainly for mainly the relaxation. I do go to a gong class as well, which I totally enjoy, listening to gongs and just sleep for an hour and you go into very deep meditation. And the noise of the whirling of the gongs and the crystal bowls, the vibration is meant to go through you and relax you. And it's a healing as well. It's a form of healing. So that's very needed. I do that once a month. Otherwise, I just relax at home with my husband. I sometimes potter around the garden. Not in this weather, mind you. But otherwise, I'm very sociable. I go out with all my friends and a lot.
Lovely. And I liked that. Some of that resonated with me. I like the gardening. I like spending time with my other half. And the gongs is not something I've experienced, but I think you have. You have, haven't you, Jo?
I have, yes. And it's really an odd sensation, but it's really nice. It can depend on your mood and the type of gongs that people are using. It's very much in that kind of alternative therapy kind of area. Yeah, so it can be quite a variable experience. Like, I've had some that I've really, really enjoyed and some that have made me feel uncomfortable. But I think in a similar way to things like meditation, sometimes those ones that are uncomfortable are maybe what you need at the time. And the idea is it's kind of shifting alignment inside us, but also tapping into that really primal thing that we all have for music and beats and sound. So it's a really interesting experience. If you have opportunity to go to one, then give it a go. It's interesting. It's not for everybody, but it definitely gets you into a nice state of relaxation most of the time, which is lovely. Cool.
Yeah. This week we're going to be looking at what it means to become expert and how do we tread that path from not knowing anything about a subject to being a master in that area of knowledge.
And we all know experts, you know, we work with them every day, all aspects of the work that we do and the people that we work with. And if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably an expert in what you do too. But how did you get there? How did they get there? And what can we learn about that process to make our teams work the best as they can to use that expertise, but also to continue to develop it?
And a little while ago, I was organising a training day for some of our registrars, and I came across, well, I've sort of been aware of Professor Niebuhr's work for a little while, but it really sort of resonated with me with what we were discussing in the training day. So I got in touch with him, and he did something for the training day for me, which was fantastic. And then he's offered to help us out again today. And so we recorded this with him. We normally use a specialist recording software, but this was on Zoom, so the sound quality might sound a little different. But this is a discussion that Joe and I had with Roger Niebuhr. Enjoy.
The MDT podcast.
So for the next bit of this episode, we're going to be joined by Professor Roger Niebuhr, who I've had the luck really to interact with a couple of times. He helped me with a training day that I was running for some of my registrars, where we went through some of the aspects that are covered in his book, which is called Becoming Expert, The Path to Mastery, where Roger talks to and learns from people in lots of different specialties about what it is to become an expert. Some of those thoughts are also distilled in a really excellent podcast called Countercurrent, and I'd recommend that you have a listen and have a dig around through some of those episodes. They're really nice, sort of well thought out interviews with just
interesting, really, really interestingly diverse group of people. And in your model, Roger, you talk about a sort of a kind of a typology, a strategy, really, of how people become expert. And that's split up into three aspects. The first is you talk about being an apprentice. Then you talk about being a journeyman. And then you talk about being an expert towards the end of that. And within each of those, there's sort of subtle things that, that seem to be common.
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me onto the podcast.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. This model, I mean, of course, this is a model that's been around for a very long time. This is a way of thinking about how people do become expert, and it goes back centuries. And many people will be familiar with this apprentice, journeyman, master progression, although, of course, no longer using those words in any gendered sense, I should point out. But I think one of the problems with that is that it is a description rather than an explanation. And so what I've tried to do in the book is to unpack those various stages and think about what is happening from the perspective of somebody who's going through those stages rather than from the perspective of somebody standing on the outside watching. Mm. And so the apprentice stage, just to summarize them really, is when you're beginning to lay the foundations for what you want to do. You're spending a lot of time, really a lot of time, in somebody else's workshop or environment, more or less doing what they tell you to do. And you're gradually building up a series of skills and sensitivities and ways of perceiving the world, which are often different from what you think at the time. Because at the time, especially if you're quite young, but if you're starting something new, it's pretty boring. And you're doing a whole lot of stuff you really don't want to do, but you have to. And you think that it's a waste of time. But actually, in retrospect, it isn't at all a waste of time, quite the reverse, because that's how you become familiar with the materials you're working with. That's how you become familiar with the people you're working with, the environment, how to behave, how to do things. And if it's an environment like ours in clinical medicine, where you're learning to interact with all kinds of different people, colleagues, of course, but also, of course, patients, that's where you're laying the groundwork for developing the skills and the confidence to make connections with people you've never met and do things.
And you're talking in the book about...
And it's an interesting time because you're kind of, in a sense, protected from the inevitable wrong things that you will do by the environment that you're in, which expects you to make mistakes, and it protects you and everybody else from the bad effects of those mistakes by only allowing you to work with things that aren't precious or particularly vulnerable or whatever. And somebody else takes responsibility when things do go wrong, as they inevitably will. But one of the things that happens then, I think, is that you get that sense that what's happening to you is all about you. It's about the skills and the knowledge that you're acquiring, and then you have tests very often, you know, exams one sort and another. And by the time you get to the end of that, after a number of years, you very often feel that it's really about you and the things that you've learned to do, and you're proud of them, and you want to show other people that you can do them. And you're on the verge of then going into this next stage, which is the journeyman stage, as it used to be called, where you then take responsibility for the work that you're doing and you make your living out of it. You go out and you become a craftsman or whatever. In the old days, you go across your country, you journey across it, and you make things, or you do things, or you provide services, and you get paid. And I think this is a really interesting stage because in terms of the internal processes, I think you need, in a sense, to set aside that thinking it's about you and realize that it only makes sense in terms of what that does for other people. And if you're a clinician, it's your patients and your colleagues, of course. If you're a, I don't know, if you're a furniture maker, it's the people who will buy your chairs and sit in them. If you're a whatever it might be, it's the people who experience your work. If you're a performer, it's your audience. So it's not about you, it's about them, is an idea that came to me from performing magicians who pointed out that all that preparatory stuff makes you very good at doing things with your hands, but it's not magic. It's only magic if there's someone else who believes that something impossible has happened. You can't do that because you know what you're doing to make it seem impossible. But it only works if somebody else, if you change somebody else's human experience of what you're doing. But at the same time, it is about you, because at this stage, you're moving from just being a sort of somebody else who comes out of a production line, being able to do stuff, to becoming, you know, Ian or Joe or whatever, geriatrician, with your particular unique qualities that make you different from any other geriatrician or performer or stonemason or anything like that. And then finally, you come to the stage where after many, many, many years or decades, you get to the stage where you are what would be called a master, where you have responsibility for other people who are following along behind you. And when it's not about you, it's about them. The them is not only your patients, your customers, your audience, but the people whose careers you're trying to support and help and shape. What I was saying at the beginning about the error, I think, is changes its nature as time goes on, because to begin with, you're making these mistakes. It's inevitable. Everybody recognizes that. You're protected. By the time you get to the stage of being a master, you've made so many mistakes yourself that you and the other people at that level know that making mistakes is essential and that you're not going to be able to avoid them, but you need to work out ways of minimizing them and recovering. The stage in the middle, the journeyman stage, I think is very interesting because the big world out there does not expect you to make mistakes and it does not forgive you when you make them, but you will. And so there's something about the sort of vulnerability of that early independent stage that is often out of sync with the expectations of the society you're in, but also the institutions that you're in, where, again, you're not really expected to make mistakes. And I think that that's particularly evident in clinical practice. You know, when people are making that transition to becoming a consultant or becoming a principal in general practice, say, or something, when all of a sudden you're in a different area and the expectations are very different. And so understanding this sort of internal journey, this internal landscape of these stages, I think can be very helpful because it can help us identify in other people and in ourselves where things are going right, but also particularly where they're getting stuck or they need a bit of help or they're not going so well.
And I think as clinicians working in a team on a ward, I think that it really resonates with me. And I think one of the things you're saying about, you're talking in the book about being an apprentice, is that you use the phrase from the cooking world, the mise en place, the getting your workspace organized. And I think that's something that I really see with the multi-professional teams on the wards, that as people become more experienced, they know sort of how they want that workplace to be organized. And we have, you know, we have artifacts that we use to do that. So we have paper lists with our patients on, and we have whiteboards, and we have this, that, and the other, you know. And I think people get more comfortable with that with time. And there's something, I think, when we're thinking about how we as people within a team sort of integrate people into our team and how we sort of hold that space open for people to allow them to get comfortable is really important.
And I think that's a very interesting one. I think it's also, there's a question of, as you become more experienced, perhaps you recognize that you've got more agency than you at first suppose. And I noticed this with particularly, you know, at the university at the moment and looking at people who are early on in their training, when they go, for example, to an outpatient clinic, they sit in the chair where it is and their patient sits in the chair where it is and they leave their computer screen where it is. It doesn't seem to occur to them that actually they could make small changes that might make a big difference in terms of who is able to see whom and in what way. And, you know, all that kind of thing, which requires a bit of confidence, but it also requires a bit of a sort of sense of what may be, what can be changed and what can't be changed, and what reason might you have for making adjustments. And if you then think of not so much about how you're just going to do your work in that clinic in that way, how it might make somebody else feel, and whether, for example, you looking at your computer screen is something you can include in a consultation, or whether it will make somebody feel alienated, or, you know, whether you're at the same level or different levels physically, all these things that as experienced clinicians we know a lot about. I think when you're earlier in your career and you've just been focusing on the things that you see as important to pass your exams and get to a particular, you may not be aware of those things. And that becomes even more important when you go out, perhaps in as geriatricians, or certainly as a GP, when I was doing it, doing home visits, when you're having to make sense of an unfamiliar environment and still allow it to work clinically. Mm. You know, that sense of broader picture of an environment that you can to some extent modify for the purposes of a clinical encounter that are a bit different from that environment for watching television or cooking a meal, you know. And so there's something about recognizing that goes back to that earlier idea about mise en place and learning how to organize your workspace and things. If it is an unfamiliar workspace, it's worth being able to rethink that so that you can make any changes you can make that will help you, but which are easy to overlook.
The other thing I think that, again, thinking about how we can sort of engender this, foster this sort of development within our teams, I think about the sort of the doing time you talk about in the book, about sort of the seeing the cases, you know, building up that caseload. And I think there's a few things that we, without getting political, I think we've organized training in a certain way at the moment. Mm. And rightly or wrongly, that is how it's organized. And I think something about the continuity that we can build, and ways that as multi-professional teams, we can build in that continuity or feeling of continuity, even if people are off and back and off and back, and discussing cases that we have had on the ward that maybe have people who have left, so that we can help people build up those, I think the medics would call it like an illness script, you know, this sort of this idea of, oh, right, I thought that person had an exacerbation of COPD. Oh, they did. Right. That was what an exacerbation of COPD can look like. But if you don't follow that up, when you come away from thinking this person's got an exacerbation of COPD, if the final diagnosis is heart failure, you've put the wrong diagnosis in your little script. And I think as people working with older people, with the complexity that we deal with, it's worth going over those cases and getting a multidisciplinary view of what we've done with cases to try and engender those conversations so that we can build up that doing time.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. Yeah. And I mean, I was greatly influenced by a bespoke tailor, Joshua Byrne. I've been working with for a long, long time now. And he, you know, he talked about his initial training as an apprentice when he was spending time, you know, ages and ages doing repetitive things that he thought were incredibly boring. But actually they were very useful because, you know, he was learning to experience the subtleties of different kinds of cloth and material and different types of tweed and different types of what thread felt like when it was going, you know, all that kind of stuff. That was at the beginning. But then as he became a cutting tailor, you know, working with customers to try and work out what it was that they wanted a garment to do, or to not only to look like, but make them feel, then, and worked with them to create things that came into existence through a series of fittings, between each one of which the garment was completely dismantled and then reassembled slightly differently. He began to get a different sense of, and particularly since he works with people over a long, long time. So it might be that he makes a suit for somebody and then 5 or 10 years later, they've changed their shape. They've started to stoop, or they've got a big tummy or whatever, you know, having to make changes. That idea that things are not fixed forever, but they evolve, really made me think about these long-term relationships, certainly that I had as a GP, and which I'm sure you have as geriatricians, where you are getting to know people and you're having to make sense of how perhaps an illness appears or is manifested in that person, which is not the same. The same illness would be different in another person, if you see what I mean. And so this idea of moving away from the textbook idea of what sepsis looks like or chronic obstructive airways disease or something, and saying, okay, well, you know, what does this look like in this person? And now 2 years later, what has changed? That kind of approach, I think, is different from the impression of clinical practice that certainly I was given as a medical student, because I think it's something that you develop as you become more experienced, which is what I meant about having to lay the groundwork of these many instances of a particular thing and what they look like, smell like, feel like. But then thinking about how those express themselves as individual people progress and get older and different illnesses and, you know, all the rest of it. And that continuity is something that I think we're particularly aware of in certainly I was as a GP in that stage of my career. And I guess in geriatric practice, you would also have that perhaps more than in some of the acute services. Yeah. When I was doing trauma surgery, it was mostly people who'd been stabbed or shot, and you'd look after them very intensely for a few days or weeks, and then they'd go away and you'd never see them again. Very different from this seeing how people's lives unfold.
Yeah, I think you're very right. I think it's something that we see more in the outpatient setting than we do on the wards. Often the way that things are structured, you don't necessarily get the same patient back to the wards, do you?
No, but even on the wards, I think we are more prone to certainly organising ourselves for longer term continuity and recognising the real importance of that. So if someone does need to be in for several weeks, that actually seeing that person throughout that admission is... you need to have seen that whole journey if you come in for 2 week chunks.
As a consultant, it's very different from being a someone in training, isn't it? Because I guess you're going to know from the day you become a consultant that you're probably going to be there for a very long time, and you're not rotating every 6 months. But or at least that's and certainly in my experience as a GP, that was the expectation that once having joined a practice, you would be there for the long haul, and so a different set of expectations, I think, all round.
I'm really fascinated by this whole conversation, so I'm being uncharacteristically quiet while I just absorb it all in. I'm thinking we're talking quite a lot about medical training, and I think it's a clear analogy. Obviously, a lot of our listeners are not medics, and I wonder how some of this translates to, I'm particularly thinking nursing colleagues, but also physiotherapy, for example, who develop a clinical expertise with older adults, but don't necessarily have like a curriculum to work towards for that. I know that we have advanced clinical practitioner curriculums now for frailty in particular, but I wonder if it's different for them because of the slightly different stages, or whether not necessarily being recognized within an organization for what you're developing in that way, what that means. So they get that recognition. Does it, I assume it still happens anyway, but it's just less overt.
I think this idea of a pathway, starting off not knowing much about it and having to spend a time, and then going out and then doing it, and then becoming so experienced that you can help other people along the pathway. I think that's something that you see all over the place. I mean, I quite agree with you. Sometimes it's recognised and it's acknowledged with titles and or stages, and sometimes it isn't. But I think that, I mean, certainly in my experience, much of the really, really powerful learning that I experienced was from people who were, nursing colleagues or physiotherapy colleagues or occupational or pharmacy. There are all kinds of people whose expertise was there all the time, but which I think I wasn't really invited to recognize. A penny had to drop before I really did start to recognize what a wealth of experience there was and possibilities for learning all around me all the time. But I just, I just missed it.
It probably comes back to that. It's not you, it's them.
I think so.
Element is that you start to see everyone else around you. And
I think you have blinkers on. At least I think I had blinkers on. Yeah. I mean, certainly in my own experience as a surgeon, I was thinking about this recently. I just sort of would need to do an operation on somebody. They were on the list. I turned up. Everything was there. It was great. I did the operation, pushed on. I mean, it was ages before it really sort of the penny dropped that a whole team of people had been preparing that operating theatre for 2 hours or something, starting at 6 in the morning. And all this stuff was going on. And then when I was in an operating team and it was in the middle of the night and I was out of my depth, the scrub nurse working with me would just sort of pick up an instrument and said, sometimes I think, Mr. Hoskins sometimes likes to use one of these or whatever. All this support simply because you're thinking in a particular way and you're blanking out a whole lot of stuff that is roundabout. And I think that's one of the problems with these clear categories of doctors and physiotherapists and nurses and things, because they seem to make it clear what your job is, but they seem to make it even clearer what your job isn't. And therefore sort of pull down shutters on all kinds of ways you can learn, especially at an early stage before you've recognized that it's not about you and it's about them.
Going back to what I was just saying then, I think perhaps what I mean is, if I refine it slightly, what I perhaps mean is that the progression is different. So a lot of band seven roles for nurses and physios and lots of areas come with a lot of heavy managerial responsibility. And obviously that's where, you know, the AHP consultant roles have come in, is to recognize people with that clinical expertise and to allow them, you sort of, you know, the autonomy from their skills. But actually it's hard, it's not quite the same, is it, in terms of recognizing, okay, a band five has this amount of experience, a band six, there's a slight shorthand, but actually you could have people that are very clearly masterful at a band six level who aren't interested in that managerial stuff, or you know, they enjoy this, but it's so it's recognizing that around you, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And that's what I meant, that's what I meant about this being an explanatory pathway of what happens to individuals, which is often out of sync with the expectations of the institution that they're in. And I think what you've been talking about is the categories imposed by the institution, and people may not conform to that. They may be at a different stage of development, or they may be developing in an unconventional way that just simply doesn't fit. But it's quite easy to overlook and to think that people are not fitting into the institution in the way that they should, rather than thinking that the institution needs to change in order to be congruent with the people in it. And that's a difficult one.
I have some truly expert healthcare assistants that I work with who are expert, you know, at their role. And I learn loads and loads and loads from them. And I think it's recognizing those within the team, isn't it?
I think it absolutely is. And I mean, I think thinking in terms of professional ecosystems makes a lot of sense, you know, that there are these interdependent parts and that they are really indivisible. And it's, you know, it's easy to overlook the water that you swim in when you're a fish, kind of thing. You know, one of those metaphors. Yeah. But until something goes wrong, until those people aren't there, or you get one that isn't functioning well, or you're not functioning well. You know, one part of the picture is out of kilter, and then you notice cracks appearing. But when it's all going very well, particularly when this is a group of highly expert people who are working together in a highly expert way, so much happens without you even realizing it, that you can overlook how complex is the mechanism. Yeah.
That feels like a good point to pause. Absolutely. Roger, thank you very much. As ever, so I'd recommend Roger's book, and I'll put a link to that in the webpage for this episode, but also the podcast, which is called Countercurrent.
Well, Roger, thank you very much for inviting me to take part. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
It's been really great.
So, Joe, what I really liked that discussion. I really like that idea of three stages to our development, that idea of, again, all non-gendered, but apprentice, journeyman, and then expert or master. And that within each stage, and in his book, it explains it really well, actually, in each stage, there are certain things that characterize that time period as you move through these three areas.
For us as people working within multidisciplinary teams, it's really important that we're making the best use of everybody within the team as well. And there's a nice team roles test you can use to help pull out some of your characteristics if you're interested. It's www.123test.com/team roles test. So have a look.
It's good
that and see.
Yeah, I did that at a leadership thing that I was at, and it's really quite insightful, quite helpful, with good descriptions at the end of the, you know, when you've done your questions and you've worked out what you are, you know.
Yeah, very useful.
And I think for us, understanding where people are in this process from apprentice to journeyman to expert is particularly helpful, as I think, as you know, we all at whatever grade really have a role within our workplace to try and make our teams work well and to try and make sure everyone is performing at the best of their abilities. And trying to understand where people are on the scale is helpful, because then you can sort of work out what are some of the potential challenges that people may be going through.
And also recognizing that we might be on different stages of that journey in different aspects of our work as well. So while we may be an expert in one thing, we may be a complete apprentice in another, or we might be between apprentice and journeyman in most aspects of our work. And that's, you know, the stage that you're at, and thinking about it, and not in a binary sense.
Yes, exactly. And I think for me, particularly the understanding of it's not about you, it's about them, the them being whoever, I think is really key in the way that teams work, because the them flips from being your patient to also other team members. And so sometimes when you find that urge that you really want to say that thing, you can ask yourself, well, why am I saying that thing? You know, am I saying it because I want to go, look, I know all this stuff? Or actually, are you saying that thing because it's going to improve the journey for the patient or the rest of the team? And I think you reach a point that you notice that, I think.
Your ego is less and you can transfer it over to what is needed rather than what you're pulling on,
So Roger has talked more in depth about this model with me before and has kindly said that he will allow us to put that out as an extra episode. So it was done as a bit of an interview a couple of years ago, as I said, I mentioned earlier for that training day. And so we will put that out as a separate little episode so that you can listen to more of that at sort of greater length and more depth. But I'll also put a link to a YouTube video where he's talking and giving a lecture about similar sort of topics.
The MDT podcast.
So now on to our breathing of the week. As promised, we have another one for you. But last week was the box breathing, which was one of the whiskey breathing sessions. And here's how our faculty found it.
Hi, it's Sophie here, and these are my thoughts on the box breathing exercises. I'm so much more focused in the exercise and not thinking about anything else, just I think because I'm visualizing that shape in front of me and my breath going round. And I think that gives me sort of extra effects of feeling more grounded, and with the box breathing, more relaxed afterwards.
And this week we have a new one for you, which is called Bellows Breath, and this is a coffee breathing exercise.
Hello and welcome to week 6 of the MDT Breathing Challenge. So this week we'll learn another coffee category breathing practice called Bellows Breathing. You're aiming to weave these practices into your everyday routine just as effortlessly as you would brush your teeth or have a shower. So as soon as you get up, sit down on the edge of your bed, or maybe even on the edge of your bath, and you can add this to your morning meditation or exercise regime, whatever works for you. So coffee breathing practices stimulate our sympathetic nervous system. So they get our body ready for action, ready for exercise, ready for focused work, any kind of physical activity. And bellows breath is a forced inhale and a forced exhale. And we're doing about 2 breaths per second. As this is a vigorous and stimulating practice, there are a few contraindications to watch out for. So clinical anxiety, high blood pressure, pregnancy, epilepsy, hypertension, panic disorders, or PTSD. So if that's you, then just give this one a miss and focus on one of the other exercises that are balancing or down-regulating. Now, before we begin, place your hand on your abdomen just to make sure that you're moving your abdomen correctly. So as you inhale, your belly should fill like a balloon. And as you exhale, your belly should fall. So inhale, exhale. Good. It's a strange tendency, but people do tend to breathe in the opposite way. So people tend to pull their belly in when they exhale and relax or blow their belly out when they exhale. So just make sure that you're doing it correctly. This is a forced inhale and a forced exhale. And on the inhale, your belly rises. And on the exhale, your belly falls. So let's do this seated, planting both feet flat on the floor and move your back away from the support. And if you're sitting on the floor, just sit cross-legged. So we'll do 20 rounds together and we'll repeat that 3 times. We want short, steady breaths in the nose and out the nose. In the nose, inhale. Out the nose, exhale. On the inhale, your belly goes out. And on the exhale, your belly goes in. So let's practice together, starting with an inhale. And let's begin in 3, 2, 1. Inhale, X, 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 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And good. Just relax and breathe normally. Totally normal if you might need to grab a tissue at this stage. It's a normal part of the practice. So just a couple things to remember. It can be easy to get out of control with all of our coffee breathing practices. And out of control might sound something like this.
And that's not what we're looking for. It's also easy to mix up the motion of the inhale and the motion of the exhale. So just remember, on the inhale, the belly goes out. And as on the exhale, the belly goes in. So let's practice again. Starting with an inhale, breathing in through the nose. Let's go for round two in 3, 2, 1. Inhale, X, 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 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Good. Relax and just breathe normally. There can be a tendency to build tension in the face, even in the shoulders and in the neck. So just avoid that by trying to relax your face, just relax your shoulders and bring all of the work down into the lower abdomen as you literally pump the breath in and push the breath out. So let's go for our final round, starting with an inhale in 3, 2, 1. Inhale, X, 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 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Good. And just relax and breathe normally. Just take a moment to notice the effects of that practice on you, just noticing what you notice. So that was the coffee breathing bellows breath, and we did 3 rounds of 20. And by the end of this practice, it's very possible that you might feel lightheaded or dizzy. And when you breathe quickly like this, you throw off lots of carbon dioxide, which is vasoconstricting. So that means it closes off your blood vessels just a little bit. And it also closes up the back of your throat just a little bit, which is what causes you to feel temporarily dizzy. This is a strong practice in that it affects you both psychologically and physiologically in your nervous system too. So it creates changes within your body very, very quickly. Great to have you here. Keep practicing and we'll catch up again next week.
We're hoping that you will be doing these exercises along with us in the episode, but also, you know, taking them and practicing with them during the week. Give us your feedback on Twitter or via the website. And on the website, there are a number of surveys that you can fill out that give you a breath MOT before and after the series, and also look at your stress levels before and after the breathing techniques over the series. And there's also a feedback form on there so that you can tell us what it feels like. You know, this is an experiment for us just as much as you.
So that's us for this week.
Yeah, we don't have an article of the week because we've talked about a book. And I think that probably summarizes a whole host of articles. Yes. I would recommend his book. It's called Becoming Expert, The Path to Mastery. It's a really, really well-written book that summarizes a lot of complex educational theory in a really nicely written way with some really good worked examples from Professor Kneebone's career. And I'd really recommend that to you.
And also, as a sort of alternative to articles, he has a podcast where he talks to really interesting people. So if you liked the way that he thinks and talks, which we both do, then have a look at his podcast.
Yeah, it is called Countercurrent by Roger Kneebone. And it's conversations with him and interesting people who think a bit differently.
So that's it from us for this week. The MTT will reconvene in 1 week's time.
The MDT Podcast.